From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at the budget proposals for Milwaukee County and the City of Milwaukee and learn exactly how they're using funds from the American Rescue Plan Act. Then we'll speak with the artist behind the You Are Loved Pride billboards, which originated in Wisconsin and have spread to other states.
I did not set out in any way to start a grassroots campaign or even design a billboard. It was more, I wanted to make myself available to do something good with my art.
Plus, we'll learn how a soundproof arena is making it easier to study frog mating calls at UW-Milwaukee.
I started doing all my experiments outdoors in the tropics, had just outdoor arenas, and that meant it got dark, I could work. The sun came up in the morning, I had to stop.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The city of Milwaukee has been facing budget shortfalls for years. As a result, essential services have often faced cuts in the budget. But this year, with help from the American Rescue Plan Act, the city has the money to support these essentials, at least for now. Both the city and Milwaukee County recently released their budget proposals for 2022. And as always, the Wisconsin Policy Forum has been analyzing what they could mean for the future of our area. Rob Henkin is the president of the forum, and he joins me now to talk about these proposals. Rob, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
To start here, what are the biggest takeaways from these two budgets?
Well, Joy, it's interesting because I think for both budgets, the biggest takeaway is how the huge infusions of federal American Relief Plan Act dollars are being utilized. But as we'll get into, there's actually a big difference between the way the city and the county are doing so. So just starting with the city of Milwaukee, unfortunately, the city's structural problems continue to worsen. The city for years has struggled from an imbalance because essentially its major revenue streams are not growing at a pace that can allow it to meet its primary pressing expenditure needs. The city is very reliant on shared revenues from the state of Wisconsin, and that revenue stream has been frozen for 20 years. Meanwhile, on the local level, the city does have the ability to levy property taxes and to increase fees, but there are some limitations there as well. So essentially, the bottom line is that the city this year found itself with a very large hole based on both that structural problem I just described, as well as the fact that it has really leaned heavily on withdrawals from reserves in previous years. Those reserves are now at the point where really those withdrawals have to be minimized because there just simply aren't enough dollars left. So as a result, in the 2022 proposed budget by the mayor, there would be about $35 million of these one-time federal dollars that are essentially used to plug holes to ensure that there are no drastic service reductions and to really also keep a lid on the property tax increase, which is about 2%, which is actually lower than it's been over the past couple of years, where it was about 3.5%. And there are no increases in major fees. So the good news is that those federal dollars were available to do that. The bad news is that once they run out, and the city should have the benefit of this for at least another couple of years after 2022, but come 2025, the structural hole in the city budget is going to be even greater. So that's clearly something to look at going forward. By contrast, the county was able to make ends meet for 22 in the county executive's recommended budget without having to use their ARPA dollars. Their allocation is smaller than the city's, though it's still very large. It's $183 million, whereas the city's is $394 million. But County Executive Crowley is only recommending the use of $4 million of that big allocation to help with the operating budget in 2022. There are no service cuts in that budget to speak of. There are also some opportunities for new investment in that budget. And the best news from the perspective of Milwaukee County is that the bulk of those dollars are preserved to take care of, for instance, some of the county's huge infrastructure needs, to take other steps to try to pave the way for easier budgets in future years when those dollars are exhausted.
So when we're looking at especially the city of Milwaukee's budget and their extreme use of these ARPA funds. What is that money going to? It seems like it's really just going to the regular maintenance of city services.
Well, that's largely correct for the portion that is being directly allocated by the mayor in this budget. So there's roughly 95 police department positions and 95 fire department positions that are essentially being supported exclusively with these one-time federal dollars. And so using the dollars in that way means that property tax levy resources can be used for other things. In this case, the other things are to essentially maintain existing service levels in other departments. There's also a slightly higher recommended amount going into the city's pension reserve. And that's very important because there's going to be a huge spike in the city's employer pension payment come 2023. So starting to or building that reserve further is important. But essentially, you're correct. I mean, this is sort of a maintenance of effort budget, and it is only that way because of the use of these federal dollars. Now, that said, the mayor is saying he wants to use $35 million for this purpose in 2022. He is recommending that $50 million apiece, so a total of another $100 million of that allocation, be preserved to essentially plug operating holes and try to offset the impacts of this huge increase in the pension payment in both 23 and 24. Still, that leaves about $260 million for other things. And just recently, there have been a raft of proposals from common council members about how to use those dollars. And the mayor also has his suggestions in that regard. Big chunks recommended to be put into affordable housing. The Office of Violence Prevention would get an additional $8 million. There would be an infusion of some money into reckless driving prevention. So again, the city does have a luxury the county doesn't have in that its allocation is that much bigger. But the big concern is, as I said, that these dollars will be exhausted by the end of 2024. And then the question becomes, what does the city do next?
When you look at the budget that is coming out of Milwaukee County versus the city of Milwaukee, it really feels like a tale of two cities, or I guess a tale of two municipalities, as it were. What are the structural realities facing the city of Milwaukee that aren't necessarily facing the county?
I think the starting point is the pension. And that's really ironic because, you know, for two decades now, the county has been just struggling with these extremely fierce challenges caused in part by some poor decision making right around the turn of the century in the so-called pension scandal, where benefits were promised that really couldn't be paid for. But because the county has been grappling with this since roughly 2002, it sort of has the situation relatively under control. Now, it's very precarious. If the stock market does not produce good returns on pension fund investments for the county, then its pension contribution could skyrocket. But for the most part, while most would agree it's paying too much into its pension fund on an annual basis, it has adjusted its budget to be able to do that. So its problems stem, similar to the city's, from the fact that things like just regular employee health care, the desire to provide cost of living salary increases to employees, factors like that cost money, and the county too doesn't quite see the revenue growth that can cover those costs. For the city, again, adding to that basic fundamental problem, which perhaps is more severe than the county's because police and firefighters are not covered by Wisconsin Act 10. So the city has less ability to unilaterally control the growth in police and fire salaries. And public safety is a much bigger part of the city budget than the county budget. But really much more above and beyond that is the fact that now the city is facing a full-blown pension crisis. And that's caused primarily by the fact that prudently, the city's pension board and city leaders agree the assumption that the city actuary has been making that those pension fund investments are going to grow by 8% annually. That needs to be ratcheted down to 7.5% just based on actual performance in recent years. And so this is complicated. I don't need to get into the weeds any more than I already have. But essentially, because of the need to adjust some accounting assumptions, because of the fact that people are just living longer and other factors, this city employer contribution toward an unfunded liability has to skyrocket. next year in 2023, so the year after next. And that just causes a real devastating problem when layered on top of the structural problem that the city has already been struggling with.
So right now, we're not really facing cuts to the different services the city provides, the county provides. Is that going to change in the next couple of years?
I think with regard to city government, the likelihood is yes. Again, it's hard to say. And the real defensible part about the mayor's recommendation to use a significant portion of these American Rescue Plan dollars to plug gaps in the operating budget and to avoid service cuts for 3 years is that the city now has 3 more years to plan for this. Now, the city can do all the planning it wants, but if it doesn't get some relief from state government, either in the form of greater latitude to look at new revenue options or some increase in its shared revenues, then it's hard to imagine how it can possibly afford this pension payment without having to produce big cuts in city services. Right now, city budget officials are forecasting that up to a quarter of the city workforce, believe it or not, might be in jeopardy if nothing else changes once these federal dollars run out. So I don't think there's any question that that's going to happen if things stay the same. But again, they now have 3 years to see if anything changes in that regard. With regard to the county, there's a big problem for the county transit system. And there was a special pool of additional federal money that the county received to help the Milwaukee County transit system, which it is plugging into the operating budget over the next few years to try to maintain transit services. Once that special pool of federal transit dollars runs out, that's a big problem for the transit system, which could be looking at either major cuts in service or alternatively to the county to substantially increase the amount of local resources, i.e. property tax levy, that is being used to support transit. And in that case, once the regular ARPA dollars run out, if the county has to put more property tax levy into transit, then it may have to take it away from other county services, so there could be cuts there. So I think both governments, you know, the good news is for a few years, it looks like dramatic service reductions are going to be averted in both governments. But come 2025, the possibility of such cuts will come back with a vengeance.
All right. Well, looking just a little ways in the future, these are actually just budget proposals. What's next for them?
So right now, the budgets are in the hands of two legislative bodies, the Milwaukee Common Council and the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors. They will continue during the month of October to hear from department heads, craft amendments, vote on amendments. And ultimately, in early November, both bodies will adopt an amended version of the budget, which will then go back to the chief executive, the mayor and the county executive. He may issue vetoes, and then those vetoes would have to be voted upon. And so there will be final budgets by the middle of November for both governments. And then that's essential because property tax bills then get sent out by municipalities in late November or early December.
All right. Well, Rob, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you very much, Joy.
Rob Henken is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and he joined me to talk about the budget proposals for the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. If you were driving to and from Madison during the summer, there's a good chance you saw a billboard with the words, "You are loved," over a rainbow flag and superimposed with flowers. That billboard was designed by Madison-based artist Ray Senarigi, and it was originally intended to just be up in June for Pride Month. But thanks to a grassroots campaign, the billboard has expanded to states like Montana, Minnesota, and North Carolina. And it can be seen on lawn signs, t-shirts, and stickers. Senarigi spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and he begins by explaining what inspired him to create this billboard.
This year has been unprecedented in the amount of anti-trans legislation that's been trying to be passed across the United States. And as these bills were being introduced, first there were just a few of them, and there were literally dozens happening. Over the spring, I was feeling pretty frustrated and very, you know, sad for the trans youth, because really these bills aren't affecting someone like me who's an adult. They're really targeted at trans youth, so children who are in school and even in college. And I just was feeling really like I didn't know how to help, right? I was making artwork, I was putting it on Instagram, but it felt a little bit like shouting into the void. And there came a point where I was like, I have to do something tangible. And so I ended up reaching out to some folks here to find out who was doing work on the ground in Wisconsin. And I was connected with the folks at Fair Wisconsin and GSafe. And, you know, I just reached out to them and told them, like, look, I have a bunch of artwork that I've already created. Is there any way that I can give you some of this artwork to use to help you raise money and help you do the work that you're doing? And they already had a billboard selected and purchased for the month of Pride Month, so for June. They showed me the artwork that they had, and it was fairly simple. It was just a rainbow flag with the words "Celebrate Pride." And so I asked them, if I could redesign that, and we talked through it a little bit. And I really wanted to have this be a message that could, if I could say anything to those trans youth who are struggling, who are feeling attacked by adults in their states, who already are at, high risk of suicide. If I could say anything to them, it was like, I wanted them to know that they are loved, that there is the whole community of people who support them, who love them, and who are fighting for them.
Right. And that phrase it's simple, but it's powerful and inclusive and can really go a long way. You mentioned they already had a billboard planned that featured a pride flag. So was that kind of your parameters that inspired you to then make your own design? And we'll have the images for listeners to look at on our website if they haven't seen this already. But the design of your billboard, it features the Progress rainbow flag along with some superimposed flowers and the message, you are loved. So can you share what went into this design?
Much of the work that I do as a fine artist is actually painted portraiture, but I'm also a graphic designer by trade. And a lot of times my portraiture work takes me months to create. So it's a slow process. I can't do something that's reactive, right? And so doing typography work has been a way for me to create artwork in a little bit faster fashion. And it's been one of those outlets that helps me kind of react to things that I think are happening out there in a quicker fashion. So that a lot of my typography work over the last, I'd say, 2 years, I've developed this kind of combination of type design and flowers. And I've noticed that I really like doing it, I enjoy it, and that people really resonate to it. And I think that there's something powerful with the flowers. A lot of times the flowers that I make, I kind of suggest movement, like that these flowers are kind of floating, that there's motion. And there's just been this really interesting kind of visceral reaction that people have had to this message in particular. And I think that something about those flowers evoke emotion in people, along with the words, obviously.
Are the particular flowers that you chose, do they symbolize anything to you?
No, I like the illustrative aspect of the flowers. And so I'm trying to add new flowers all the time and draw new flowers for my own self. But, some of them are kind of accurate flowers and others are a little bit of a mix of my own imagination and flowers that I've seen.
For sure.
It's more about the essence of that feeling, I think, that flowers give us than it is about a specific flower.
As you mentioned, your main body of work is creating these amazing, bright, colorful, larger-than-life paintings of transgender and non-binary people. How did you find your creative process differing for this billboard and in your typography work? What do you find yourself working through or thinking of when you're doing this versus spending, as you said, months on a large-scale painting?
Yeah, they are very, very different processes. The portraiture work is this kind of meditative. It's also like I'm using my whole body because the work is large. And so I'm, up and I'm down and I'm sitting on a chair and I'm kneeling and I'm over here. And really, the digital work is very different. I'm sitting at a desk and I'm illustrating on a tablet and it's much more sedentary. So I actually have to take, I think, more breaks when I'm doing digital work than I do when I'm doing, physical painting, which you'd probably think it would be the opposite. But the digital work is helpful for me because when I started basically focusing on fine art about 5-6 years ago, after surviving cancer, I made a promise to myself that I would not only dedicate time every day to my fine art, but that I would base all of the artwork that I'm creating from a place of love. And so that has been true with my portraiture work, but it's also been true when I'm in kind of a reactive space, like what I just described, you know, where this came from. It came from a place of pain and anger. And instead of, you know, creating something that was about what I am against, right, I tried to flip that and get a message out there that was what I wanted, you know, what I want those folks to hear, and not just trans youth. Like, this has been resonating with folks who are all across the spectrum. And so the digital work really helps me do things in a quicker fashion. And it helps me, you know, being able to use words sometimes is necessary. And so it's also just this like completely other kind of creative aspect.
This billboard, as you mentioned, was initially just for Pride Month campaign in Madison, but it's since grown to be featured in other cities. It's turned into bumper stickers, yard signs. It's grown a different life of its own. So can you share how this turned into a grassroots effort to share your art and this message?
It has. It's been a really incredible ride. So you're right. It started as one billboard. It was supposed to be up for 1 month. It actually ended up being up for 3 months here in Madison. And we knew right away when we got it up that, like, we thought that the message was going to resonate. And then it was very apparent that it was resonating strongly. And so the billboard came, and we followed that up with bumper stickers and yard signs that are for sale through Fair Wisconsin. And I had folks reaching out to me from all across the nation saying, you know, I really like that. How do we get this in our state? How do we get this where we are? And so, you know, I did some thinking, I did some talking with Fair Wisconsin and the GSAFE folks to discuss like what could we do. I didn't want to take away from what we were doing here in Wisconsin, but I do believe like getting this message out as far and wide as possible is a really positive thing. And they agreed. And so we actually made it possible to make a donation of any amount to the Equality Federation, which is an organization that helps all 50 states fight for equality. And so we set up a special page where you can make a donation of any amount to that organization, and I will get notified. And then I work with those folks in those areas. So I'm really relying on people in whatever area they are. They will know where the billboard is that, you know, would get a lot of traffic that people would see. And for instance, I had a friend in Montana who wanted to get this billboard up, made a donation, I think in June, and then finally was able to, a couple of months later, find three different business owners who each donated 1 month of billboard rental. So they got the billboard up, and then one of those business owners put it out to the community and said, hey, you know, we want to get this billboard up for another month so that it is up for the rest of the year, basically, through the end of 2021. And they put it out, and within about 2 weeks, they had such an influx from the community that the billboard is going to be up for the next year. So like people really, like I said, they're really resonating with this image and with this message. And I think that people want to put positivity out into the world. They want to further this message, and they want it on their cars or in their yards or, you know, on a billboard. And it's just had a profound effect on me that people, you know, have taken it upon themselves, have donated their own money to get this message out there. And it's just been really powerful to watch.
How have you felt, in addition to seeing the community response and have it spread beyond Wisconsin, but also to have your art be impactful, not just in your traditional gallery space that most of your career is focused on?
Yeah, it was completely unexpected. You know, I did not set out in any way to start a grassroots campaign or even design a billboard. It was more that I wanted to make myself available to do something good with my art, you know, to put myself out there in whatever way that I could. And I think that that's really what I found powerful about this, is that whatever it is that you have a talent for, you know, finding a way to put that to use to furthering a cause or, you know, trying to make a positive impact in the world. I think like there are people who, you know, can phone bank and that is helpful, or they can, maybe they're a lawyer and they can help in that way. I wasn't able to do that, but, you know, I was able to give my art. And so I found a way to do that. And I think it's just been a really humbling experience. I'm incredibly grateful for all of the love that I think I have gotten to receive by people taking this message and making it their own and bringing it further into the world.
Well, it certainly is a beautiful message and billboard. So Ray, thank you so much for joining me to talk a little bit more about it.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Ray Senarigi is a transgender non-binary artist based in Madison. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about his You Are Loved billboard. And you can see pictures of his work at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 12 minutes, we'll learn about the historic Concordia neighborhood, which is now expanding its 360 virtual tours of homes. But first, we'll head to the Frog Arena on the campus of UW-Milwaukee to look at an innovative way researchers are learning more about frog mating calls. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you've ever spent a warm summer night on a pond, you've undoubtedly heard a chorus of frogs calling into the distance. These calls come from a variety of male frogs, each searching for a potential mate, and most of them reliant on the strength of their call to find one. But understanding how these calls work and what makes them attractive can be difficult in that environment. Dr. Gerlinde Herbel wanted to create a space where she could study the eastern gray tree frog without the distraction of the pond. So she and her students created the ideal environment by converting a commercial freezer into a soundproof room with a small frog arena in the center. There, they can play male mating calls through speakers set up around the arena and observe which ones female frogs seem most attracted to. I joined Dr. Herbel at the Frog Arena to learn more.
I started doing all my experiments outdoors in the tropics and had just outdoor arenas, and that meant it got dark, I could work. The sun came up in the morning, no matter whether I had frogs or not, I had to stop. So I always dreamt of having an arena where basically I can control the environment completely. And then I got this and I built this, and it's a very nice place to work in.
It's a really fascinating thing to think about, that you would end up wanting to be in an environment like this to really study this. It makes sense when you explain it, but I'd like to take a step back first and really look at what the mating ritual is like for frogs. How does that generally play out?
Yeah, so for most frog species, they have a relatively short breeding season, sometimes a couple of nights, sometimes a couple of weeks or a couple of months, when the weather is just right. It has to be warm enough and it has to be wet enough, and enough water has to be available, especially for species that breed in ephemeral ponds. And then during the night, males get together at the pond and they start calling. And they call for a couple of hours, and if a female is ready to lay eggs, she will walk to the pond and then among this multitude of males, pick out the male that she finds most attractive. And then she will actually move over to the male. And males are often very excited about calling. So quite often they don't even realize there's a female. So the female has to tap him a little bit. And then they pair up, which is called a plexus. The male goes on top of the female. And then they wait a little bit because now the female has to get ready to lay eggs. And eventually the female will actually carry the male to wherever she decides is the best spot for her eggs. And then they lay eggs for the rest of the night.
It's interesting that the male frogs become so enthralled with the calling that they might not recognize there's a female there. And it gets to this question that I've had of, why are they calling? Is it showing something to female frogs when they call? Is it exhibiting some kind of behavior that a female frog would say, that's very advantageous.
There's different hypotheses about why males call. I mean, the main reason males call is in order to mate at all and procreate to the next generation to pass on their genes, they have somehow to be found by a female. And for some species, we know the call can encode specific things. So there is a study out that shows that our great tree frogs, actually, our eastern great tree frogs, males that have very long calls, which are super, super attractive to females, these males actually have good genes that help the offspring, the tadpoles, grow up better in certain environments. So not all environments, but many environments, they grow a little bit better, grow a little bit faster, which helps them escape the relatively dangerous environment of the pond.
Well, it seems like that's really at the crux of your work in this space. So right now we're in a soundproof kind of box, and there's a small arena in the middle of it that's kind of sectioned off here. How does this work, and why this environment?
How it works and why it works is kind of a special feature of the mating system of frogs and also of crickets and a bunch of other animals. And that is that females have a behavior that is called phonotaxis, which is move towards sound. So a female that's interested in mating will move towards the sound, and in nature it's a calling male. And we can kind of take advantage of this behavior, move it into a lab environment, and then instead of having a live male here, we have a speaker that plays back either recorded sounds or computer-generated sounds. And the female in this really like completely not natural-looking environment will still, if they are in the mating mind, if she hears something that sounds like a call, she will hop over to it. And so that really facilitates any type of experiment. Because I don't know if you've ever been at a pond at night when the chorus is really, really rolling. Trying to do any type of experiment there would be really hard, because your speaker would get drowned out by the natural sounds of the frogs. But in here, we can control everything and still get the female to do exactly the natural behavior. And if she doesn't want to, she just sits there and doesn't move. So we can't force her to do anything. If she plays with us, we get data. If she doesn't play along, we get the next one.
Sure, that makes sense. When you explain it like that, I think a lot of people would say to themselves, well, why not just do it at a pond at night? Why not just do it outside where all of us have heard frog calls? Mm-hmm. But trying to untease which calls belong to which frog, which, you know, female frog is going to which male, must be borderline impossible.
It would be very hard. But it's important to remember, we always need to have a little bit of background information of what's happening at the pond. We can't just make up everything in the lab. So there has to be a kind of a natural component where we go out first. Before we do any type of female experiment, we record a whole bunch of males, because we need to know what does nature give the females. Yeah? And then we can make computer-generated calls to play around with that. But it all needs to have kind of its basis in nature.
So far in this space, have you gleaned anything about the kinds of calls that female frogs seem to be most interested in, intrigued by?
Yeah, so for our great tree frogs, there are two things that they really find super attractive. One is a very long call. So they have trilled calls, so a call with many, many pulses, that's very attractive. Females also like calls that are repeated very, very frequently. So if you kind of add those together, it basically means a male that produces a lot of sound energy is very attractive to the female. Yeah. And so one of the interesting things is calling is energetically really, really hard for the males. And normally a male can either make long calls and then he has to do more breaks, or he can call very frequently, but then he has to make his calls shorter. So most males, if we compare them, tend to have kind of a relatively similar amount of sound energy that they put out, but some put it more into the length and some put it more into the repetition. And what Kane found out is, one of my grad students, is that there seem to also be females that are either the long caller, preferences or the more repetition preferences. And so what that means for the males in the pond is that there isn't really just one perfect male out there. So on average, females want longer calls. But some of them want really, really long calls, but others want fast calls. And so there's basically the perfect female for almost every male out there.
So recognizing that we are right now in an empty arena, and as we talked about previously, the lady frogs are no longer in their mating season. Is it possible for us to hear what those calls would sound like in here?
Oh, absolutely.
Good. There you go.
So there are currently two calls playing. There's a really short call, which every respectable female would say no. And there's the longer call, which is close to the average in our population. And that's something they would find quite attractive and hop over to get. And you can hear it's quite artificial sounding, yeah? But it has all the qualities that are important for the call recognition in the frogs. It has two frequency components. In nature, they have many more. It has the requisite amount of pulses. In nature, it's much more variable, but it has what needs to be there, and that makes our life easier in computer generating those sounds.
So they can hear then, essentially, where it's coming from in here, and you know that they're responding to whichever side of the room.
Yeah. And see, back here we have our speakers hidden, and they're on purpose hidden behind a wall because we really want the females to pay attention to the sound and not get distracted by there's a black box over there and maybe they just want to go hide or something. We just really want to have them pay attention to the sound. Show us what they want. And often they hop over there and then they kind of sit in front of the speaker and just, where's the male? Where's the male? They're quite fun.
Thank you. This is a really cool thing to hear. Dr. Gerlinde Herbel is an associate professor at UW-Milwaukee and heads the Herbel Lab of Anurin Behavioral Ecology. I spoke with her on the campus of UW-Milwaukee inside her Frog Arena, a commercial walk-in freezer that was converted into a soundproof room to study frogs. You can find photos of the arena at wuwm.com. Coming up, we'll learn about the historic Concordia neighborhood, from its history to its grand houses. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Milwaukee's historic Concordia neighborhood has a rich history dating back to 1850. Old world craftsmanship is found in mid-size homes and large mansions alike, with architectural styles ranging from cream city brick Gothic to Victorian and mission style homes. Many of the neighborhood's historic mansions were demolished in the 1950s through the 70s. Others were converted into rooming houses or left to decline. But Historic Concordia Neighbors Incorporated keeps preservation and education as their main mission in keeping up the homes that remain. This year, Historic Concordia Neighbors is offering free virtual tours of homes in the neighborhood, including the Manderley Bed and Breakfast. Andrew and Marie Parker are the proprietors of the B&B, and they spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last month about their neighborhood.
So going into a bit of the history of the neighborhood itself, you know, when was it first really established and what was it known for? You know, why is it called Concordia?
All right. So the cool thing is when Concordia wasn't really here, it was just a road that went through here. And it was the Watertown Plank Road, which was a toll road, which they built with, you know, big timbers, and they laid them all the way to Watertown. And that route eventually became State Street.
And when they decided to annex it as the city, then they established the street grid pattern, which makes for an interesting place in a couple of different areas. You can still see where the old Watertown Plank Road was, because the houses are set back strangely compared to the rest of the city grid.
You mentioned before that a lot of houses were established during the Victorian era. A lot of these homes are bigger, you know, it's a lot were converted into rooming houses later on in their lives. But to have such a big home from the start, what kind of people were first settling in the Concordia neighborhood?
The people who first settled in, yes, they primarily from Germany. And you think about settlers, early settlers and late settlers, they're escaping from something, not these guys. They came with pocketfuls of cash. They came with their bakers, their brewers, their craftsmen, and recreated. They called it Little Berlin here. So Concordia was known as Little Berlin or New Berlin. And so that spread, come on down. We've got these great churches and houses and everything's taken off and the weather's fine. Right. Come on down.
So the whole area was primarily settled by wealthy Germans. And these eventually, you know, that was the early settlers. And then eventually it became the wealthiest area of the state. These were the power brokers. These were the Pabsts and the Millers and the Harleys and the Davidsons and many, many very, very rich and powerful people from the state of Wisconsin lived here, including our house, which is pretty cool.
We did a little research on, so we're about 2 miles straight west from Lake Michigan. And Victorians felt that lake air was not good for your constitution. You couldn't live right on there. So they went and swam and kind of vacationed on bodies of waters, but not to live. So that is why we are this far away from Lake Michigan.
Right. If you look at a map, an old map of this area of Milwaukee, it kind of juts out and it's called the West End. And it is where the rich people lived and played. Cold Spring Park at that time was a racetrack. And back in the day, horse racing was a big deal in Milwaukee. And they had the state fair there every year for many, many years before it moved to the state fairgrounds. So if you look at Cold Spring Park, which is just to the north of us, that used to be where the people of our area used to go and play and make bets and all of that.
Washington Park was the zoo.
Right, Washington Park was the zoo. So we had close proximity to some really cool things. So Cold Spring Park is now all houses and they've filled in like after 1900, basically, is when that filled in. But ours is, you know, our house was built in 1886 and it wasn't the first one around here. There were many around.
You guys currently operate the Manderley Bed and Breakfast in one of these very grand old historic Victorian homes. So what made you want to do this? And did you always want to run a bed and breakfast in Milwaukee? I mean, I feel like a lot of other states maybe are known for bed and breakfasts, but we don't think of, oh, I'm going to do a staycation and go to a bed and breakfast in Milwaukee in a different neighborhood.
It is so funny that you say that because when we got married, we went and stayed in different bed and breakfasts all the way down to Jekyll Island, Georgia. And then we were hooked. By the time we got back, we knew we wanted to have a bed and breakfast someday.
But Milwaukee, that's unheard of. There's no breakfast in Milwaukee. And we did a little preliminary research and found out there are so many rules and regulations against the bed and breakfast from the hotel industry, like the B&Bs are going to take over. So we started vacationing and every vacationing to find a B&B. So every place where we went, we did our research and looked at these great old homes, but they were a million and a half plus. And then not even everything that was on our checklist that we had written out. So then we were living in Concordia, like we say, and so kind of searching and not even thinking about Milwaukee, you know, ready to make the move.
It was not even on our radar.
And lo and behold, this house comes up on the market. And we took a tour and it was exactly what we were looking for. It had everything on our checklist. It had the double doors when you walk through. It had the open grand staircase. It had private quarters for us. It had 8 bedrooms total. It had a giant yard and on and on and on.
It was missing a lot of things.
because it was turned into a rooming house, so it was missed a lot, but yet it had everything that we were looking for. It just needed a lot. We call it brand fixer upper.
Right. It had the potential to have everything we wanted. We hadn't really considered an urban location as ideal, but it turns out an urban like location for a bed and breakfast is perfect.
Because there's always something going on in Milwaukee year round that it attracts.
Well, and I imagine you always had a project going on when you first bought this house, and it took you about 7 years to put it together to the standard you wanted in order to operate a bed and breakfast. So what was your favorite challenge?
Wow, favorite challenge.
Well, that's a good question.
Do those two words go together? Yeah. The most dramatic challenge was the house was missing almost all of its stained glass windows. So what do? You measure your stained glass windows, write down what is needed in what rooms, what would have been appropriate. You know, we know the age, we've researched everything, and you got stained glass window shopping and you find they don't fit. They're too expensive. This isn't going to happen. So Andy had already been dabbling a little bit in making stained glass windows, and he's very creative, very artistic. So he starts drawing and turning these drawings into stained glass windows. And he's created, some in every room, some stained glass windows in every room. They're pretty dramatic and awesome. And lots of people think that they are original to the house, which is quite a nice compliment.
That is a good compliment.
I think the worst challenge, but you have to do it, is stripping woodwork for me. That is the most tedious, hardest things. All of our mantles were missing. So we had to find mantles that would fit and that we could afford. We know that what was here was probably larger and more grand, but these are pretty cool mantles and appropriate to the year. And we could afford them because they had 10, 15, 20 layers of paint on them. Mm-hmm. So that took quite a long time, and toothbrush and heat gun and chemicals and all of the above to strip and bring back these cool old mantles.
Yeah, the stained glass you mentioned, one thing that struck me looking through some of the photos of your home was the grand, awesome oak double doors with the stained glass in the windows. Like, and I also assumed, that must have been there. How amazing is that?
Why, thank you.
Thank you. Those doors weren't even there.
So the inside vestibule doors were missing. So the people who turned this mansion into a rooming house stripped it. They took out those double doors and sold it, the headset, to us to San Francisco. So a lot of the goods from the house are living on in San Francisco.
Seeing your home, you know, obviously people can stay in it, but with the historic Concordia Neighbors Incorporated, there are both in-person self-guided tours, times of year they can go into homes, but now there's also a virtual tour. So what was the process like to take the landscape of the inside of your home and turned it into a digital tour so that we can explore it on our computer screens?
We have a secret weapon, and that secret weapon is a human called Scott Witte. And he is a professional photographer, and he does those 360. He specializes in that. And
right. He's our neighbor also. He lives over on Highland, and he's a genius with anything video. And he moved into it from still photography. He's an advertising photographer. And he made it so easy, to be honest with you. All we did was, you know, clear the room out and, you know, make it pretty. And then he would come in and make it visual for anybody who wants to see. So it's great.
Yeah, a group of us got together, and it was a grant, Andrew?
I believe so.
And to make that happen, to make that app happen, and it is widely received. We've gotten calls from all over the country. And how did you do that? What was your first step? What was your second step? It was a big project.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the biggest thing is getting people to agree to have their home fully photographed, and not just a still photo, but you know, you're really going through it. And we are very, very lucky in Concordia that everybody gets it. Everybody sees that this is a value to everybody in society to be able to see these houses, explore the history behind them. And it's an important asset to Milwaukee. And we understand that. So everybody kind of opens up their houses when we ask them to, and they're private homes. They're not museums. So they're just people just like you and I who are living in a house you know, doing the repairs, fixing it up, and they just happened to be some pretty cool houses.
Yeah. So through hcni.org, we already have that app, and it was doing quite well. And then we added on to it for the last two home tours. We stayed virtual for 2 years through COVID, and we ramped it up. We added all kinds of new houses and new features and private chats with homeowners. So it's really incredible now. And we wouldn't have gotten to the level that it is now if we wouldn't have gone virtual for 2 years. It's pretty spectacular now.
Andrew and Marie Parker are the proprietors of the Manderley Bed and Breakfast in Milwaukee's historic Concordia neighborhood. Their house and many others are available to be explored in 360-degree virtual tours. You'll find a link to that and more at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look into how students of color are being supported as they transition into higher education. Plus, we'll learn more about what's playing at this year's Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.